welcome to this week's episode of 1010 Would Recommend. It is me, it is I, it is she, Talani.
And it is me, it is I, it is she, Gina.
See, that's such a nice intro.
Yeah, that was nice.
Yeah,
was
it
nice.
Makes you feel like of importance, like maybe a granular one, but still of importance.
Today's a really special episode. Really excited to have another guest on, because we didn't have guests for so long with the last season. And this one is very important. Mm-hmm. And just to do a content warning beforehand, this episode, we're speaking to the wonderful Rowan Deacon, who is the director of Jimmy Savile, A British Horror Story, which is a documentary that's already come out, actually, on Netflix. The subject matter deals with things like sexual assault, so there's content warning there, but it was really important for us to get Rowan on the podcast to speak about it. Talani and I have both watched the documentary.
Yes, we have. And during it, we were like sending voice notes to each other to be like, oh my God, this is horrifying to watch.
Yeah.
Like, in a way that, like, I guess we're old enough to have seen the first bit where it was like, oh my God, this person's so cool. And it's just so interesting how the name now sends like shivers down my spine rather than like, and this is the magic guy.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. So what like actually brought you onto this? What drew you onto this project to be like, yeah, I'm gonna do this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good question. So I think initially the size of it, I think the revelations around Jimmy Savile are, I don't think you can underestimate how much they sort of reverberated around a whole nation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, and they changed, they were the sort of beginning of a lot of change that we've lived through in the last 10 years in terms of like attitudes towards women and sexual assault. But also I think that they led to really complex feelings in this country around shame and complicity.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that we've worked through those yet. And I think that, so I suppose I was attracted to the idea of telling a story about something from the perspective of the bystanders, i.e. all of us, rather than relitigating his crimes, which the film doesn't actually do. I think there's the sort of expectation that that's what we're going to do, and we don't. We're much more interested in really factually laying out how he got away with it, rather than just what he did. And I was really interested in that. And I guess I lived through it as well. I mean, lived through it from a position of someone in Britain, like we all did. And there has been a lot of, kind of, it's well-trodden territory, I guess, in this country. But it felt like 10 years on, with the dust settling, was a good time to sort of approach a very comprehensive film that sets out the how rather than the why. So I guess that's why.
Do you know what? It's so interesting with documentaries where I have this constant thing when something happens, I'm like, 10 years on, we'll know the truth. Because I feel like for so long, we kind of like, just deal with it and carry on. And like, there's a new news day and something else happens. And it's just like, no, you have to wait a while. And then eventually the truth will always come out. And watching it, it's like he tells on himself. So it's just, it really creeps me out how often I felt like he told on himself.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And that note on complicity, I really felt that in the documentary, because, you know, obviously it talks about him having been this prolific figure from 1955 to 2009.
It's insane.
Which is insane. And I, you know, there was that bit where you see him in the Big Brother house, and I didn't even remember. Like, when I saw that, I was like, oh yeah, he did go to. But at the time, I didn't remember. And it really, it did make me feel like also I was complicit. Like, there was a line in it where one of the interviewees, and I forget who it was specifically, I think it was a journalist, who said, you know, the nation made Jimmy Savile. And you really get that vibe. And you're right, actually, now that you say it, it doesn't go through every single crime, but it really talks to those people who, like, looking back on the interviews that they did with him, for example, where there were chances to, or where they did feel something that wasn't right. But, like, and I think also, it's a very British thing as well. Like, Britishness doesn't really like to be very direct. We always like err towards like being polite, and being polite is often like not saying things, or when it's something uncomfortable, you're like, oh, I don't want to touch this. It's just so interesting. But I'll read that. Obviously, the feeling of complicity, people usually shy away from that. How nervous were you, I guess, to delve into that where, you know, it is probably going to make viewers feel like, oh yeah, like we were really, we were really a part of it. We're all a part of this.
So I think there was a lot of anxiety, like genuinely sort of daunted at the outset, because mainly actually not because of I wanted Britain to sort of confront the story, but I'm also aware that this was, you know, there are hundreds of Jimmy Savile's victims kind of living in this country and processing and dealing with the effects of his abuse on them, which has obviously a long-term legacy. And so we were really kind of keen from the outset to talk to victims and survivors groups and people who kind of could inform them on their perspectives of, if you're going to make this, how is it helpful? How's it going to be helpful to us? And it was really interesting that I actually came from some of those kind of, I guess we call them like consultancies, because we knew that we weren't just relitigating the crimes. It's not a harrowing litigation of his every part, one of his victims and his abuse, which is an important film to make, and they have been made. Because we were taking a slightly different approach, we were really keen to get their perspectives so that their kind of lived experiences informed what we were doing. And it was really interesting that one of the things they said was that this kind of vision that we have today of Jimmy Savile as like an evil monster who we have slain, who was just pure evil, you know, that a monster who we never liked, you know, and we never trusted, isn't helpful really to understanding the complexity of victims' experiences of perpetrators who often are charming, well-liked, well-respected, and play quite a complex psychological game. And so we felt really emboldened by that to go back to all the archive, which hasn't been seen since the revelations came out. And for good reason, there was like a sort of censoring of these hundreds of hours of footage. But we applied to all of the archive houses to start looking at that. And it was in the archive that we found, look, you can't argue with our relationship with him, our relationship of trust and our relationship of adoration. And that's something that's worth exploring, because we need to be honest about how this happened rather than sort of go, oh, well, it was all a conspiracy and we had nothing to do with it.
Exactly.
I think we avoid it because it makes you feel a bit icky.
It does.
Like, because if you, when you're watching, you watch a journalist like looking back at interviews with him, and then you, you can see that they feel like, oh my God, I knew something wasn't right, but I didn't, say anything. And I think once you feel icky, you're like, well, I'm going to stay far from it, sort of thing. And I think as a woman as well, there's a weird thing about being around someone, you're like, oh, I just, oh, there's something. And often you don't know what the word is. You don't, and if you say it to other people, it sounds like, well, because he looked at you too long. Or like, what exactly was it that he said? Maybe he was just being complimentary. And you can see the journalist watching it back and being like, shit, like, yeah, that was weird, wasn't it?
And I also think, as well as that, and it was even more complex than that, that actually the social conditions of the time were such that when we looked at this archive, the way that Jimmy Savile was behaving with young women wasn't actually that unusual. It was actually normal to pat people on the bum, to sort of break those boundaries. And so when the interviewees are looking back at that, they're sort of confronted with our own past and the, and the conditions which meant
so
that
true.
And the phrase that's often used with Jimmy Savile is he hid in plain sight. And I was like, yeah, he did hide in plain sight, but he also hid in a culture which made this kind of behaviour normalised. So no one felt like there was anything to comment on, because it was just kind of, it was just okay, and we had different but I mean, anyway, we had really different understandings of kind of of consent and who's responsible for behaviour like that.
But that change in how we saw the world then and how we see it now, it's a really weird one, because it's like, obviously Jimmy Savile has been made up to be the monster that he is and everything like that, but it's just a weird one because it's like, oh, but it was okay then. But yet, watching it, someone else watching them, and I was like, why didn't you guys pick that up? Like, it's a like, you just don't know how to feel about it. And now watching it, I was just like, he literally told us what he was doing. And here he is again telling us what he, I could literally write the amount of times I'm like, okay, that's another time he told us what he was doing. There was a bit in a documentary where he talks about when he was working in the hospital, and he was like, I helped the lass and the lads out, and when they let me, I helped the young lasses out too. And it was like,
But I think,
when no one's looking, he says, when no one's looking, I help the lasses out too. You're like, sorry, what does that mean?
And I think that speaks to the question of, again, like, it's really, hindsight is 2020, right? 2020. Like, you know, it's that tension between how do we reframe a lot of these experiences and a lot of these things that happen, you know, in 2022, when we're like, you know, it's the post-Me Too movement, and we're looking at all of these things way differently. But I think you're absolutely right, Rowan. Like, I definitely, whilst I was very like, I can't believe that this went on, at the same time, I was like, actually, I can believe it, because it was different.
It was different then,
and, you know, there are things that we probably accept today that we won't accept in 50 years' time. Do you know what I mean? And I really, it was so interesting. Those moments, I guess, in the documentary where it does feel like super ironic, because he's kind of saying the things that he was doing. Are those moments in, did you put them in on purpose, or as like to punctuate it or to emphasize the point that you were making? Or, you know, did they just happen to be there and you were like, I mean, I assume it was on purpose because you're a great director, but
no. It was a measured decision. Mm. It wasn't, we were really keen not to misrepresent the archive. So we were quite methodical and obsessive about it. We got all, there were hundreds, like literally, I spent lockdown viewing all hundreds of hours of footage of Jimmy Savile in documentaries, on TV appearances, being followed around the country with cameras from 1958 to when he died in 2011. Mm. And we just sat down and started viewing chronologically, because we just thought we need to kind of experience this as Britain did, like and there were loads of moments where we were like, oh my god. Now obviously we have hindsight, so those moments shout to us today in a way that they didn't at the time. So I do think hindsight is part of the role, but there's also a complex psychological game going on, I think, with Jimmy Savile and the British public, particularly in the second part of his career, where it was less acceptable for him to be acting in a kind of lascivious way, which he does in the sort of 60s and 70s. And I think then that he is doing... And the reason why I wanted to put those bits in, and I don't think... I mean, it's interesting because he is constantly doing it, but we haven't overly put them in.
Not at all. It's just what he was doing.
Yeah.
What I think it illustrated, and the reason that we wanted to ask our audience today to sort of confront with this, is that it also explored something that was quite disorientating for the British people, because even in the late 90s, like where what we consider a more kind of modern time, he was kind of advertising the fact that he was up to no good. Mm. And I think it was a bit like, I interviewed a psychiatrist about this, it was a bit like the serial killer who turns up at the press conference. It's a bit like, I sort of don't want to be caught, but at the same time, I kind of want you to know what I'm doing. I want to get some kind of thrill of sailing close to the wind.
Yeah,
I think what was interesting is the effect on us was to go, well, if he's saying all that, it can't be true. It was almost like a double bluff.
And it was kind of, I mean, I
was expecting to find that in the sort of early 60s and 70s footage, because it's like TV was all just pretty gross.
It really was. When you watch it back then, you're like, oh, why is he allowed to say that?
Exactly. It was kind of contextualised by, like you say, the times. But even on, like, there's one clip that we weren't able to put in of him on Loose Women in like 2006, and he's kind of licking everybody's hands, and everybody looks really uncomfortable, but no one says anything, because I guess at that time it was just, you know, oh wow, he's just a man out of his time.
Let's not embarrass him by calling it out.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there was a bit of that going on as well, and it was almost like this archive was evidence of a really complex psychological game being played between the television and the people at home. And I just found that kind of helpful to understanding it. In a way, it's one of the reasons why he got away with what he did, is that game that was being played. So I was really kind of keen to explore that.
Yeah. But then there were loads of rumours as well. There was loads of like, yeah, we have heard. Oh, yeah, someone did say it. And that went back for years. People were like, yeah, I did hear that he likes young kids, or I did see him drive off with young girls and things like that. So there was loads of rumours. But, and then I think it plays in power with that power.
Yeah.
Like, what we see as superstars, when we see them on television, it's like, oh my God, they're these people that can't do no wrong. And he's helping kids fly, and he's doing this for them, so he can't be a bad guy. So it's just kind of like how television makes us look at celebrities, that they are unable to do anything bad. Mm. And that's why whenever we hear anything, we're so shocked. Like, oh, I never thought he would be that kind of person. Because TV has told you that, oh, look how great he is. And look at the power of like how you can create your image. Mm.
Yeah, I think that was something that particularly the first film explores, is how Jimmy Savile's relationship with those in power, not just through fame. So fame was like level one, was that he was loved and famous, but also his relationship with the royal family, with the establishment, with Margaret Thatcher, that gained a kind of it was a trust that sort of sealed his approval in the eyes of the public. So that, I mean, obviously we then explore how some of the women who, I mean, those rumours must have come from the source, right? There were hundreds of victims, right? So those rumours came from some truth.
Yeah.
And then when there were women who did in the 90s come forward, you know, in the first example to the Mirror in 94, they felt like they didn't want to go to trial because they actually felt ashamed of their past and their involvement in it. They actually felt like they didn't want to testify because they worried that Jimmy Savile would, with his kind of public image, win the argument in court.
Yeah.
Because it was just all they had as evidence was their testimony. So I think it's a film that also explores testimony and what weight we give to certain people's experiences versus others. And in that sense, it's a bit of a cautionary tale, I think.
Yeah,
so I'm looking at both of you.
No, it's absolutely fine.
No, it's absolutely fine. Yeah, well, we're just intensely staring at you
as you're talking as well.
Doing great.
I'll keep still.
No, it's totally fine.
Sound a bit serious.
I did want to ask, you know, since you've spoken about those testimonies and the shame, that, you know, how hard was it, or what was the process actually of getting those interviewees on board to be involved in the documentary?
Yeah, I think so. A lot of the interviewees in the film aren't Jimmy Savile's victims. There were we deliberately wanted to speak to people who were people that had known him in order for us to kind of understand the effect that he had had on people who didn't know what he was, who didn't actually know what he was doing.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
And I think there was a lot of anxiety from those people about speaking, about having known and not done anything with their, I mean, their knowledge. What did they know? They knew what we saw. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And they were often confused and bewildered about their role in the story. Mm. So in terms of speaker, I guess we do what I'd always do, which is to be really transparent about what we were trying to do.
Yeah.
And we obviously had engaged with them about how they are probably going to come up against social media questions and criticism. I mean, that was something that we just did from the outset.
Yeah.
I think that they felt that because we were engaging with the archive and because, and we made a kind of rule, actually, there's only one interviewee who doesn't have a first-hand witness testimony, by which I mean we didn't want to talk to anyone who just had an opinion.
We needed
people to be there at the time, so everyone met him, knew him, is in the archive.
Yeah, has a stake in that story. Yeah.
Sort of was there, because we felt like there's quite a lot of chatter about Jimmy Savile, quite a lot of rumour.
Right,
and we really wanted to root it in experiences of people who had been there. So the process of getting them on board was really one where we engage them in a relationship of trust, that, that this is what we're trying to do.
Mm.
We're not trying to mislead you. Mm. We're not trying to misrepresent you.
Yeah.
But we are trying to kind of needle something that's quite difficult for the, I think, the nation to confront.
Yeah. Yeah.
And with regards to survivors as well, interestingly, from that perspective, there was more keenness for the story to be told. There's more kind of like the survivor we interviewed in the film, although that we've also consulted with lots whose bits of archive we used, because we tell it as a kind of historical story as well.
Mm-hmm.
She was like, I have to live with this all the time. I have to live with this. So I why can't you live with it just for like an hour and a half?
Oh my God, absolutely.
So there was a lot with her around, you know, what was her motivation for telling the story again, because she has told it before. And she was really keen that the film explored us, our role in it, but also that it didn't shy away from some of the more harrowing and shocking and violent aspects of child abuse. So there is a very kind of difficult section in the film for viewers, but Sam was really keen that we didn't censor her.
Yeah.
And she said, I've had to experience it. You experienced it for 5 minutes.
Gosh, I think that's the thing, that it's discomfort. Really, because I remember watching it and feeling like, you really feel like, I want to turn this off.
Yeah.
Because it feels so uncomfortable with it. And I think so many Brits are going to feel quite uncomfortable with it, especially the older lot, because it's like, it was Jimmy Savile sort of thing. What do you want them to take away from it? Look, two questions. And secondly, what are you worried that they might say about it?
Oh, God, that's interesting. Mm. Yeah, I mean, what's the... Because I was thinking about this in terms of morality, and I think one of the things that the film does is complicate the morality. Like, it isn't a really sort of... there's a lot of, what would you describe it? There's quite a lot of like social media hysteria and conspiracy theories around Jimmy Savile.
Mm.
And I think that I wanted to, rather than present a really kind of moralistic film, to present a film that shows just how complex the reasons were as to why he got away with it. It's not a film that's about blame. It's not about saying, it was because of Prince Charles, it was because of Margaret Thatcher, it was because of some people at the BBC who... It was actually trying to say, without blame, let's look at the sort of society that we lived in and the attributes that we pin on the establishment, fame, women, you know, vulnerable women. You know, let's look at where we value all of those and just kind of learn from listening to the history of it.
Yeah.
Rather than presenting a kind of strict moral... I mean, it would be reductive to say... child abuse is bad. You know, I think we know that.
Yeah, exactly.
I think the film tries to do more than just say, this was bad, and to say, but how does it happen and how do we facilitate it?
Yeah.
I think in terms of the... I think that the Jimmy Savile topic is like really triggering in this country. And I don't mean triggering for survivors, although I accept that in some cases... it may be a difficult thing for those people to revisit as well. For some of those people, we can't sort of talk generally, can we? Everybody's kind of got their own experiences. But I think for the public, it makes people really angry. Mm. And I think it makes people angry that we're going over this. Mm. And I think that, I think therefore that's really interesting.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that we get so kind of anxious and angry about this subject matter, and I think that is precisely the reason why it's worth us confronting in a kind of... that's what storytelling is, isn't it? It's sort of helping us to come to terms with and make sense of our world. And so I know that there will be, like, we shouldn't give him airtime. I suspect that might be one of the and I would just argue that the film is quite complex, and to engage with the film rather than the sort of social media conversation, it's actually trying to sort of complicate and make sense of something rather than just add to the hysteria.
Yeah, it's really weird because I feel like Britain is that one big family, and Jimmy is like the dirty uncle that nobody really wants to talk about, and we act like he never happened. Never loved him at one point. Yeah. We never knew him at one point, but it's like, actually, the family picture showed that actually he was in that picture. Yeah. He was invited once before. We do so actually know him.
No, but
we
can't act like he never existed,
because it's like a dark little secret that we just don't talk about. Uncle Jimmy, not my uncle. I have no relation to that man. I've never met him in my life, but Britain's Uncle Jimmy. We don't talk about him and we bury him deep down somewhere. But he did all of these things and he should, like, it should be talked about. A story should be told. One thing I was going to say, my only worry is, right, so there was a part in it where we start talking about his mother and his relationship with his mother, right? So I have this thing where I feel like documentaries or anything that talks about, like, bad people somehow go to, well, it was his mum's fault. And I hate that narrative, especially when it includes men, because I feel like women are always at some blame at men's downfalls. Or maybe she loved him more. Maybe she didn't hit him more. Mm-hmm. And the more I watched it, it wasn't so much that, but I was really worried about that being a thing. I'm really funny about people's mothers being blamed for monsters of children.
Totally. I totally get your anxiety with that. And we had anxiety. In the end, what's interesting is we could not find any evidence that the mother was to blame theory was in it. He factually, he did have a very close relationship with her. Mm. And so we included that because it's just part of what he talked about, but we suspect that that's because he wasn't, because of his, obviously, he had sort of hugely psychologically damaged man, wasn't able to form relationships with anybody in a grown-up way. Mm. So his relationship to his mother was one, like a primary attachment that didn't then, that didn't go, you know, even after she died. But we had exactly the same anxiety that you always go to the, it's always like,
it's always the
monster. It's because of the mum. Actually, we didn't find any evidence of that. And in terms of exploring, and also we were very conscious, I don't think the film spend much time exploring why Jimmy was like he was. We weren't interested in offering him any excuses or explanations. Right. Yeah. That wasn't, you know, I think that sometimes films about famous bad men spend a lot of time looking at, like, an explanation that can sometimes read as a justification.
Yeah.
Mm. We weren't really interested in that. We touch on his mother because his relationship with Catholicism, I think, is quite important.
Yeah.
And the religious kind of, the way in which he talks about his sins on television as a way of kind of atoning for his mysterious crimes that we now know what they were. But we were also cautious of that narrative. Mm-mm. And so I think it's like, actually, it's one bit of the film where we're like, what are we saying about the mother?
Yeah.
And we're just sort of presenting her because she's there and because she was a figure of importance in his life.
Yeah.
But I don't think the film comes to any conclusions because we didn't really feel like we could because there was none yeah. that we could find.
Yeah, absolutely.
Does that make sense? It may be a frustrating element in the film, though.
Because when I saw it, when the first was like, and his mum, I was like, no, not his mum sort of thing. So it's like, yeah, I realised that as well. And it just kind of stops there. And that's that relationship. And there was no like blame, which I was very happy about.
I had one last question. and it was actually, I was doing very much a like A-level dissection of the title.
Oh, English comprehension.
Yeah, I was doing the English comprehension. Like, explain why this title was chosen. Obviously, you could have just called this Jimmy Savile. You could have just called it, but it's called Jimmy Savile, A British Horror Story.
Mm.
And we've kind of spoken about, complicity. We've spoken about the nation, the British public having created this person. And in the documentary, it talks about, how Jimmy Savile, part of what made him successful, his rise to success, was that he was Northern, these are very specifically British things working class that make this British person become a British success. And I just wondered whether for you, when coming up with that title, A British Horror Story, what to you, was that on purpose? Were you specifically pointing out that this is the way in which this person rose to fame, the components of that person's fame, and the way in which this all played out is a specifically British way of it playing out?
Yeah, I think the title was partly because we felt like it was an unusually national story. It was a story that engaged every institution, involved every institution of a British institution, from the royal family to the government to the NHS to BBC. Like every one of us.
So right, wow.
The church.
Those are all British. Yeah. Royals, NHS,
so
BBC.
True.
Yeah, so British.
So I suppose it was more the national nature of it than the British exceptionalism of it, I think. But I do, I mean, it is an exceptionally British story, but I don't think that's to say that it's not a story that couldn't play out with those kind of power structures elsewhere.
Does that make sense? For sure.
But it's a uniquely, I think also there's, it's interesting because obviously the series is going to be launched on Netflix internationally. Mm-hmm. So I think that we were really conscious of making sure that people understand not just that this was national as in like the scale, but also that it is something that's very much part of our history.
Yeah,
I think you're right that the exceptionalism of Jimmy Savile, that the Jimmy Savile story certainly couldn't have happened in another country.
Mm-hmm.
But I think similar kind of abuses of power, obviously.
Absolutely, I think you're absolutely right.
And horror story, actually, we went backwards and forwards with this, but actually I think that what's the most sort of why I think it is a horror story for everybody involved is that the most tragic and sort of damning and horrible aspect of it is the betrayal of someone that you trust has actually turned out to be not what you seem.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's a kind of almost like a horror trope. Like,
like a monster in town. Yeah.
And I think that, I don't think horror actually over exit. I think it was a horror story for the survivors. It was a horror story for everybody that knew him that felt somehow complicit. Yeah. And it was a horror story for the nation because it's almost become like a kind of bogeyman from which we are recovering.
Yeah.
So I think that's why that title was chosen. And also we didn't want it to make it about him. Obviously, we had to use his name.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't want to call it like the monster or the like paedophile because we wanted to, because I think the film is as much about how he deceived us as it is about how we were deceived.
Yes.
So we wanted to kind of spread it out a bit in terms of the focus not being just like an examination of Jimmy Savile, because I don't think anyone would be interested in looking more into him. It's into us, if that makes sense.
Ooh. Smashed it with that answer, babe.
Yeah.
Slightly lighter. So you did fantastically. Thank you so much for being transparent and honest about it.
And
the documentary is really, really great.
It's really, really great.
Really, really, really good and important. And it's really struck. It's that line that you said that Sam said. So what's his name? Sam. Said about I have to live with this all my life. You
can watch an hour and a half.
You can watch an hour and a half. This is really struck me because I think that's absolutely right and it's really important. So every time we have a guest on our podcast, because obviously our podcast is called 10 out of 10 would recommend, we ask our guests to recommend something on Netflix. So obviously we're already recommending your documentary, which is fantastic. But if you had to recommend something else, what would you recommend to our listeners?
Well, weirdly, I was actually, the other night, I saw some friends and who hadn't watched The Power of the Dog. And I know that. Is that a bit of a one that everyone
Do you know what? I still haven't watched it.
I also still haven't watched it.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I haven't watched it.
And it's literally just... Jane Campion's just won an Oscar for it.
It's weird. Like, these are people that I would be like, I can't believe you haven't watched it. And I was really selling it to them to the point that they were like...
Did you make it?
And they were like, oh, no, I don't like Westerns. Oh, no, I don't like... Oh, boring. And I was like, no, this story is incredible. Mm-hmm. It's like the most... I think it's a masterpiece, anyway, in terms of filmmaking. And I also think it's one of those brilliant stories that you think you're watching one story and then it completely unravels to be something else. And I found it the most... And I came across it by accident because I don't think it was like really like pushed. And I just found it... the most engaging and one of those films where you're like afterwards you're just still thinking about it.
Yeah.
And it's about like the psychological relationship between these like four characters that are really well drawn and really complex, and the fact that it's a Western, if you it's like it's not what you expect from a Western.
Right.
That's
right.
All I can say.
Okay.
Because my truth is I have to be in the mood to watch a masterpiece. Like I'll be honest.
You're absolutely fair.
Just go out of my way and start searching for masterpieces. I just I'm like, I'll just watch a rom-com.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
like, if I'm in the mood, I'll be like, okay, cool. I'm in the mood for a masterpiece.
It's not a like knackered after work. Like,
yeah,
just exactly.
I just need something.
You got to sit down and like go, okay, I'm ready for this. You've got to treat it a bit like the cinema. You know, when you're watching Netflix, but you're like, this is a cinema experience. Rather than
it just makes me really jealous of the people that made it. Like, how did you think of this?
How did you? Well, what is it? I know you mentioned that it's four characters and their interaction, but what is it actually?
So it's about a do you know what it's about? It's about like masculinity. That's what it's about.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, and it's about a cowboy who is not true to who he is, really, and the kind of damage that causes. Right. I guess I don't know how much of like plot spoilers you're allowed to talk.
Okay, so who's the dog?
There's no actual dog in it.
It's the fun title.
Power of the Dog is a quote from the Bible.
Oh, God, and I'm a Christian.
And you're a Christian.
Yeah, you learn that at the end.
Huh? Do we know? What's the whole verse?
Oh, my God.
I'm going to search.
Why are you asking her that?
It's something
about... She's brought the Bible.
I'm obsessed with the film. I should know this. And I watched it twice, because if you watch it once, you're like, oh, my God. And then you watch it again and all the clues are there. That's what I loved about it. Like, I've realised I'm watching a perfectly constructed... It's basically like a detective story, but you don't know that you're watching that.
So good.
I thought Benedict... I was like, Benedict Cumberbatch is a cowboy. Come on, guys. Like, that's ridiculous, right? He's so sort of posh in English. But... actually, I think it's genius casting because he's a man that's not comfortable with who he is. Because of like the times and the world he lives in, it actually is a really clever bit of casting because his performance of like being a macho and being a cowboy is part of his issues. And so Benedict Cumberbatch is good at that because he's kind of like a weird cowboy, right?
Yeah.
It's from Psalms 22, verse 20. And it says, deliver me from the sword, my precious life, from the power of the dogs. I'm not sure what God was trying to say.
Oh, my God.
Well, that is what it's all about.
Wait, do you know what? The Good News version is always really simple. No, none of it makes any sense to me. Save myself from the sword, my only life from the power of the dog.
And there you go.
Hold tight,
everyone,
Jesus.
Everyone watched the... Hold tight, Jesus. Hold tight the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. We love
them.
And
hold tight you.
And hold tight Rowan. Rowan, thank you so much. Everybody, please watch Jimmy Savile, A British Horror Story. It's out now. And tweet us about it on hashtag 1010 would recommend. What a babe Rowan is.
What a babe. So smart as well.
She's so every answer I was like, you smashed that, babe.
Yeah, I can't even embarrass myself about the dog. But, you know.
So where does the dog come into this?
And who is the dog, Rowan?
You haven't mentioned a woof-woof yet.
Edward a bark-bark.
Okay, so obviously Rowan gave her recommendation and her 1010 would recommend for this week. What is yours?
Completely different. Mm-hmm. Completely not smart. It's not a masterpiece. Actually, some could say it is a masterpiece, but it's not. It's a show called Is It Cake?
Oh my God, that was going to be my recommendation.
Oh my God, was it?
Okay, that's great. We can both recommend this one.
Okay, so I feel like everyone deserves something. Like, and actually, it's a masterpiece because they're making cakes out of every and anything. So, and this show is just, I think it shows three different things. The one I watched was like a sewing machine.
Yeah.
And then you have to guess which was cake, which is actually real.
It's such a simple concept, I know it sounds ridiculous,
but if you're that kind of person that's watched all of those Instagram videos of people cut into what you thought was a burger, but no, it's a cake. I saw someone cut into a microwave, but it was a cake.
What, like, where did this trend come from?
I feel
like it just on the internet exploded, and everybody for all these videos for like months were just cutting into cake.
Yeah. For like months and months. Do you know what ones used to really stress me out? When people cut into chicken. Because I swear to God, if the chicken is then it's a cake, I'm pissed off.
Yeah.
My truth is, like, and do you know what, I hate admitting it, it's such a cliche. Oh, I'm a black woman and I love chicken.
And the thing is, no one asked you to admit that.
No one told me. But I would just be really annoyed if I saw a piece of chicken that was cut up into cake.
That would
really piss me off.
The videos did start to get on my nerves.
Yeah.
Because you'd be thinking you're watching a regular video. And, like, I've seen some on TikTok where, like, the lady will be, she'll do the regular thing, like, oh, it's a cake. So she cuts it. So you'll see a meal, it's a cake. But then, like, it will go to the kettle that's boiling. The kettle is also
a cake.
Yeah, a cake.
Everything
is a cake. And then it will go to the switch. And the switch
is a cake.
Is also a cake. And I'm like,
people are really talented, though.
Oh,
I can't
so
bake
talented.
To save my life. And I realised that during lockdown when I tried to make banana bread.
I didn't even try.
That shit deflated, but that's like, it wasn't meant to look like that.
Whilst people are out there with their sourdough starters and their little yeast in a bag.
I can't bake for shit.
No.
It's because baking requires exacts.
Yeah.
And I don't like exacts when I'm cooking. It's just a dash of this, a dash of this. But it's too much, like 0.2 litres of milk. What does that mean?
Because if you put too much of something in, it's like you've fucked it.
Oh my God, I'll tell you a baking story. So we did a bake sale at work once, right? Because, you know, that was a cute thing to do. And everyone had to bring like something they'd baked. And I was unaware. Do you know when you buy food colouring, it's like a tiny little thing, right? And I just thought, oh, that's because you used all of it. So I put the whole thing into my cake to make like a red velvet cake. And it turned out green because apparently you were supposed to put two drops of it.
It turned out green?
Yeah. And it tasted really disgusting.
Ooh.
But apparently it just requires two drops. And it was tiny. I was like, I'll use all of this.
Do you know what? I think that's absolutely fair.
Right.
Same like vanilla. Like vanilla, you only need like one teeny weeny little
Who's
drop.
Who's meant to know that?
Exactly.
But yeah, hold tight these bakers because they know everything.
Hold tight the bakers. Literally, the premise of it is literally they get all of these fantastic bakers in and they essentially have to compete to be the one with the most deceptive cake creation. And then the judges come and basically have to, like, hopefully not choose their one that's cake.
Yeah. You can't tell us that we don't give you diverse content on this show.
We really do.
Oh my God.
You can't tell us that we're not doing the job.
Content queens. Where else are you going when you're getting recommended a doc about Jimmy Savile, and is it cake?
Exactly.
Range, that's what we call it. We call it range.
Yeah, get you some hosts that can do both.
Yes, exactly.
So I reckon we can wrap it up there.
I think that's it, honey.
Yeah. It's been good. Where can we find you, T?
You can find me at Tolly_T on Instagram and on Twitter.
And you can find me at Smargina on Twitter, Instagram and TikTok. You can find at Netflix UK, obviously, on all platforms, and at Netflix on TikTok. And lastly, before we go, don't think we forgot about homework.
Yes.
So for next week, what is our homework?
The homework for next week is for you guys to watch a show called The Principles of Pleasure. Mm. Hopefully you will learn a thing or two, straight men. And hopefully you will learn loads, women. No, it's a really, really good show. I've watched it, so I don't want to spoil it, but watch it, get into it. And we're going to be talking about it next episode.
Absolutely. Bye.
Bye.